The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. And today I'd like to do something a little bit different. Normally we launch straight into the news and talk about that. And instead I'd like to start with a bit of storytelling. With specifically some history telling, but in a bit more of a story format, because I think there's some fascinating history that will really help us understand a lot of very important news coming out of Europe, coming out of North Africa, that doesn't really sound all that significant without it. Over the last year or so, I've been on a bit of an ancient Rome kick, and I want to talk about that today. As I said, I think it's got a lot of relevance to some of the news coming out of Europe. And it's some history that's just absolutely fascinating for a whole number of reasons. I think one is, you know, that Roman history is just everywhere. You know, you cannot talk about power and about politics without using the language of Rome. I mean, if you look at the U.S., the seat of government in the U.S. is the Capitol building. And it's named after the Capitolium, the Temple of Jupiter in Rome, that often served as the seat of Roman government. It was on the Capitoline Hill. Obviously, there's the Senate in America, taken directly from the Senate in Rome. But let's say if you're ruled by a monarch. Well, they live in a palace. And a palace is named directly after a different hill in Rome, the Palatine Hill, where the upper classes and later the emperor lived. If you're a monarch, if you're in a monarchy, well, you have princes. And again, this comes straight from the Roman term princeps. Princeps, meaning first citizen. Originally, it had kind of connotations of the, again, more like a first among equals, but it was the title they adopted by Roman emperors. And, well, emperors, there's another term taken directly from Rome. Well, you could say, okay, well, we get quite a lot of words from Latin, but even in languages that don't, they, when it comes to politics and power, they borrow very heavily from the language of Rome. In Germany, an emperor is a Kaiser. In Russia, it's a Tsar. And both of these words are simply versions of the name Caesar. Which, to me, that's just kind of mind-blowing. It would be like as if myself and descendants or adopted great-nephew as son were such powerful rulers that 2,000 years later and thousands of miles away, if a king was especially strong, he was called a Palmer. You know, the guy's family name just became synonymous with emperor. You've got the term dictator, of course, also comes straight from Rome. Mary Beard starts her book, SPQR, writing, "Ancient Rome is important. To ignore the Romans is not just to turn a blind eye to the distant past. Rome still helps to define the way we understand our world and think about ourselves, from high theory to low comedy. After 2,000 years, it continues to underpin Western culture and politics, what we write and how we see the world and our place in it." And that's really true. And another reason that I find this history so fascinating is that we have just such a wealth of written material from Rome. I'm sure there are some pretty huge black spots that it would be nice to know more about, but especially once you get into around 100, 200 BC, and beyond, you just have a huge amount of material, more than any historian could even possibly digest in a lifetime. We have books by Julius Caesar. We have the private letters of many individuals, especially people like Cicero. You're talking about matters of high estate and just the mundane details of everyday life. We have shopping lists from ancient Rome, technical writings, novels, the speeches they gave, written up, even through tombstones across Europe, we hear the voices of ordinary people that are often left silent by history. In fact, their written material is so widespread, even today, 2,000 years later, we still use their sayings. We say things like, beware of Greeks bearing gifts. We talk about bread and circuses or fiddling while Rome burns. Idioms that come straight, that have come to us out of from 2,000 years. You start to get in more recent history, and a lot of that wealth of documented material dries up. So I think it's just fascinating to have such a detailed glimpse into a time so long ago. And on the one hand, we see a world that's very familiar. We can read their jokes and get the punchlines. Some of their crazes seem remarkably modern, like the big craze that went on for a while for celebrity chefs among the rich. And then at other times, the wealth of information paints a picture of a culture that seems completely alien. Some of it more silly, like the craze for saltwater fish ponds. Some more serious, like the Roman practice of leaving unwanted babies to die on rubbish heaps, or the love of crowds to watch, or love of crowds of watching people fight to the death. Just this dual nature of what seems really familiar and what seems really different, I think, helps us understand even just more about human nature and our own time period. This history also gives us some of the most epic true stories in the history of the world. Caesar taking over an empire only to be stabbed in the back literally by someone who was probably his own illegitimate son. Hannibal marching elephants through the Alps, driven on by a vendetta passed on to him by his father. But Roman history also has fascinating questions. How did one city end up dominating the entire Mediterranean? How did a city with a firm hatred of monarchy end up as the seat of some of the most powerful rulers in history? And these are questions I can't fully answer in today's program, but I want to explore them because they do have a lot to do with some of the latest news coming out of modern Europe. So we'll take a quick break, and then we'll get into the history of ancient Rome.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England. This is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Delenda est Carthago. Carthage must be destroyed. Three short words barked from the mouth of a superpower. Rome's death sentence on one of the most dazzling empires of the ancient world. It was a fine spring morning when Armageddon began. The city of Carthage, in what is now Tunisia, had been under fire for 3 years when the Roman army broke through the gates of the city. From that moment on, innocent people had just weeks to live. Death had come to Carthage, and no one would be spared. The orders were precise: leave not one building standing, not one person alive. What followed was a holocaust. The Roman troops would tear down Carthage's Senate House, burn its library, and defile its sacred shrines. A year's vicious toil would reduce the city to dust. In annihilating Carthage, 150 years before Christ, the Romans made a whole civilization disappear. Rome wanted Carthage completely and permanently erased.
That was the introduction to a documentary titled Carthage, the Roman Holocaust by Dr. Richard Miles of Cambridge University. As you heard there, Rome wiped out Carthage, a city in roughly where Tunis is today, in northern Tunisia, in North Africa. But why take such drastic action? Why bother completely razing to the ground this civilization in North Africa? Well, it all started about 100 years earlier. Carthage was one of the biggest powers in the Mediterranean at the time. You also had the Greeks. They were divided into a lot of city-states, and these city-states often had Greek colonies far away from Greece, elsewhere in the Mediterranean. And so, with being two of the biggest powers, Carthage and the various different Greek city-states often squabbled. One of these quarrels was in Sicily, just off the coast of Italy. And in this case, one of the Greek colonies decided to get a rising power to their north involved. They appealed to Rome for help. They got Rome involved in their conflict with Carthage, but Rome didn't behave like the Greeks. Rather than kind of treat these wars as more minor battles, Rome went all out. They went for total war. Over a course of 20 years, they forged themselves into a naval power, building navies from nothing, and then watching them sink again and building another one. After 20 years, they inflicted a total defeat, or at least a very heavy defeat on Carthage, pushing her completely out of Sicily, ending that war in 1241 BC. Now, it was Carthage's turn to up the ante. They recognized that this was a different kind of struggle, a different battle to what they normally faced with their quarrels with Greek city-states. This was a fight for life or death. Hamilcar, one of the top Carthaginian generals, he realized that Carthage would need more power if they could beat Rome. So a few years after that war was over, he took his army to Spain. He took his two sons with him, including his 9-year-old son, Hannibal. And before he left the city, this 9-year-old Hannibal swore never to show goodwill to the Romans. And Hamilcar had great success in Spain. He took silver mines in that area that went a long way to replacing the wealth that Carthage had lost to Rome in the earlier war, and really forging almost a new empire for Carthage in Spain. In the course of the fighting, Hamilcar died, and eventually his son, Hannibal, took over his generalship there in Spain. But Rome became uncomfortable with Carthage gaining all of this new territory. Eventually, they decided that Hannibal had gone too far, and they declared war. Hannibal responded very famously by bringing his army across the Alps into Italy, including his elephants. He was vastly outnumbered. He was fighting in Rome's heartland against people with able to have much shorter supply lines, who were familiar with the ground, able to reinforce much more easily, and Hannibal won. The Battle of Cannae is one of the most famous in history, and it was the Roman Republic's greatest ever defeat. 8 legions were wiped out. Rome stood open and defenseless before Hannibal. I'll just read another quote from Mary Beard's book here. She writes, "The Battle of Cannae and the whole history of the Second Punic War has mesmerized generals, pundits, and historians ever since. Probably no war has been refought so often in so many studies and lecture rooms or been scrutinized so intently by the military men of the modern world, from Napoleon Bonaparte to Field Marshal Montgomery and Norman Schwarzkopf." So it was a decisive battle in the history of the world. But this was the point where you were supposed to surrender. Hannibal had defeated all of Rome's armies. They had nothing left to stop them. But Rome did not. They would have either victory or they would force Hannibal to invade Rome and take it the hard way. They gambled everything on being able to hold out against Hannibal despite their massive defeat. And hold out they did. No one is really sure how. It's the subject of a lot of debate even today. But Hannibal did not take Rome. Meanwhile, Rome was able to send an army to Carthage. Carthage was not willing to risk the destruction of their city. Hannibal was recalled, and he was defeated by Scipio Africanus. And still, Carthage was not willing to take the same risk that Rome did, to say, well, take our city or go home. They signed a humiliating peace with Rome, and their empire was gone, their power broken. The war ended in 201 BC, but Carthage was not destroyed. They were left intact, and Hannibal, I believe, was left in charge. But this fight left its scars. The Battle of Cannae fundamentally changed Rome. They'd come within a whisker of destruction, and then they were determined never to let it happen again. It had taken a Herculean effort for them to win this fight. Historians estimate that during this war, between 10 and 25% of Rome's adult male population served in the army. And that's similar to the, well, at the higher end, with 25%, that's similar to the figures for World War I. That puts this kind of struggle in perspective, how much it affected just even everyday Roman life. That's something that's going to impact everyone. And 1 in 4 of your adults are serving in the army. If there is an undefeated foreign army about to take your capital city, it had a massive impact on Rome for the years, decades, even centuries to come. As I said, Carthage's empire had been smashed, but the city was still there. And with all those memories of Cannae, Rome still feared her, even though that empire was destroyed. Several decades later, Cato the Elder traveled to Carthage, and he reported that the city was prospering again. He returned to Rome's Senate, and at one point he gave a speech where he stood up there with fresh figs that he said had come from Carthage, that he claimed could come to Rome in just 3 days. That claim seems to be exaggerated. It seems the quickest you could get from Carthage to Rome would be 5. But he was making the point that what goes on in North Africa is going to dramatically affect us here in Rome. And if Carthage rises again, the Mediterranean is not a defense. It's going to affect us here. From then on, he finished every speech he gave, no matter what the subject, by saying, "And I think that carnage must be destroyed." And I kind of love this mental image of him getting up, I don't know, giving speeches on something like road taxes, and the taxes are high, they need to come down, and also I think Carthage needs to be destroyed. But apparently that's what he did, and it worked. Cato got his way. Rome made a series of demands on Carthage. They finally demanded that the Carthaginians dismantle their city, carry it inland, and rebuild it. That way, if they're not on the coast, they couldn't be this big trading empire, they couldn't be rich, they wouldn't be able to threaten Rome. Of course, that's an absolutely impossible demand for Carthage to fulfill. There's no way they could dismantle their city, move it, and rebuild it, and still be able to feed everybody, have access to water, etc. And it would, losing that access to the sea would fundamentally just destroy the city. So Carthage gave the only answer they could: no. And that triggered the Holocaust that we began this segment with. From 149 to 146, Rome besieged Carthage. Carthage fell, and Rome systematically destroyed the city, wiping it out, wiping everybody out, selling the minority that did survive into slavery. And that was not a one-off. Over the previous decades, Rome had become increasingly drawn into the Greek world. And the same year that they destroyed Carthage, Corinth, a city-state in Greece, had dared to disrupt a peace brokered by Rome. And Rome didn't take that lightly either. Now, Rome had always been pretty brutal, the Roman armies, even before Cannae. But after this epic life and death struggle, after they'd come within a whisker of their destruction after Cannae, they would not tolerate any of this kind of dissent. And so their armies turned towards Corinth. They very easily defeated the Greek armies, and they reduced Corinth to rubble. This was Greece's richest city at the time. Its artwork, its statues were famous around the world, and they were carried to Rome. The Romans themselves told stories about all the bronze, the silver, and the gold in the city melting in the heat of the burning until streams of mixed precious metals ran down the streets of Corinth. Now, it seemed even the more intellectual Romans at the time doubted that story. But it still gives you an idea of the tales of the destruction of that destruction that spread around. So in 146 BC, Rome destroyed two of the greatest cities in the Mediterranean in just a year. This destruction was felt all around the known world at the time. The whole world, at least the known world, I guess China would have been in contact with Rome and probably not too worried. It's a long way to march there. But at least all around the Mediterranean, they were shocked and shaken. You know, the price of defying Rome was very clear now. Rome didn't rule most of the Mediterranean at that time, at least not directly. But this gave a very clear ruling to all of any other kings and princes all around the Mediterranean. If the Roman Senate asked jump, you asked how high. Otherwise, your cities were going to be erased. The Romans shocked themselves, too. It was said that the Roman general at Carthage wept as he watched that city destroyed. The world was shocked at what Rome has done. The Romans themselves were shocked at what they had become. With that, we'll take another quick break, and I want to pick up with a slightly different strand of the story.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analysing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Ancient Rome was a violent, vengeful place. Lucius Tarquinius Superbus, the seventh king, took power after orchestrating the assassination of his predecessor. Tarquinius then moved quickly to execute senators who were disloyal to him, freeing him to embark on a string of successful conquests. But the Roman public eventually grew angry at their king's relentless demands, and when Tarquinius' son Sextus raped a noblewoman who then killed herself out of shame, the public's outrage boiled over. Lucius Junius Brutus, head of the king's personal bodyguard, seized the moment and convinced the legislators to exile Tarquinius. The Roman Republic was thus established, with Brutus elected co-consul. His first act was swearing a collective oath with his people to never again allow a man to become king in Rome.
That story may or may not be true, but that's certainly what the Romans believed and told themselves about the origins of their government. That video, by the way, was from the Daily Conversation. But Rome's government was founded, and absolutely at the core of its government was this fierce mistrust and even hatred of strong leaders, and especially of a king. Being accused of being a king or having ambitions of being a king was one of the worst and the most damaging accusations you could throw at a political opponent. This was just, for hundreds of years, fundamental to Rome's government. It was fundamental to the way it was set up. Rome didn't have one leader under the Republic. It had two of equal power, two consuls, both of which had veto power over the other. And they would rule for only 1 year, and they were elected by the Senate. All of this designed to make sure that you could not have a strong man. That you could not have one man take power. But around the time of the destruction of Carthage, this began to change. Now you start to get the rise of strong men in Roman history. Scipio Africanus, he returned to Rome after defeating Hannibal at the end of the Second Punic War as the savior of his people. You know, they'd been in danger of destruction after Carne. He'd traveled to Africa. He'd forced Hannibal to go back to Africa. He'd defeated him. He had won. And if he wanted, he may have had the chance to become Rome's king. The grateful people were willing to vote huge honors on him. He was offered to be made consul for life. So no one-year term limit for him. A lifetime consulship. But his rise in stature, the honors poured on him, they also won him many enemies. What difference is there between a consul for life, showered with all the pageantry of a grateful population, and a king? And so because of this, he was hounded through the courts, and the savior of Rome spent the rest of his life in basically virtual exile. And this set the pattern for things to come. A military victory could bring you a king-like status, even in a city founded on the destruction of Rome. Peril, if the city was in great danger, well, then they would be willing to give someone king-like status. But unless you grasp that power with both hands, jealous rivals would bring you down. And so, after Scipius Africanus, then you begin a series of military strongmen. The next was Gaius Marius. He was just a teenager when Carthage fell, but he very quickly became the greatest Roman and the greatest Roman general of his generation. He reformed the army, and in doing so, he opened up many more opportunities for the poor. His reforms also made the army much more dependent on getting paid by their general. The Marian reforms, they were a major reformation in the way the Roman armies were paid for, the way they were run, the way they fought, and it won him huge popularity within the army. But he also won huge popularity with the people. This came at its height in 102 BC when it was his turn to save Rome. Germanic and Gaul barbarians from Gaul were pouring into Italy. The general that it was sent to stop them had failed. And it was up to Marius to step into the breach. And he did. Once again, you know, winning the battle and saving Italy. And he too was showered with honors. He was hailed as the third founder of Rome. Over the course of his career, he became consul 7 times. More than any other person. He was getting awfully close to being a strong man, to being a king. What stopped him was his rival, a former lieutenant of his, Lucilius Cornelius Sulla. He too had risen fast, had a strong following with the army, had the support of a different faction, more of the traditionalists and the aristocracy, whereas a lot of Marius's support as a self-made man who didn't come from any of Rome's greatest families was much more from the people and the more ordinary people. So you had these two great figures, two rival strongmen, Marius and Sulla. And then came another threat to Rome. Rome at this time, it inspired fear across the Mediterranean, but it did not control it. And the next threat came from northern Turkey in the form of a man named Mithridates, king of Pontus. About 88 BC, Mithridates took over just about all of Turkey. The Greeks rallied behind him. Now, they remembered the destruction of Corinth. They weren't especially happy with Roman rule. So they all swung their support around Mithridates. Suddenly you had a king ruling a rival empire in the Mediterranean. Very quickly, he'd come almost from nowhere to become a serious threat and possibly a life-threatening threat to Rome. At least that's how many of the poor or many of the ordinary people in Rome viewed it. The response in Rome in some ways was, I find it's almost funny. You had, on the one hand, a lot of people that were scared and wanted to vote for a leader with great power to conquer him. And then Mithridates somehow becomes almost a sideshow in a fight between the wannabe strongmen of Rome. Marius and Sulla both wanted the command against Mithridates desperately. It started with political maneuverings to get the job. Sulla was voted by the Senate to command the army, and he left to go and command the army and take it to go and fight Mithridates and save Rome. And then Marius managed to get it overturned and himself put in command. And again, the differences between the two men. Sulla was able, had his support from the Senate, which was more the aristocracy. Marius was able to get it overturned by the people. But Sulla refused to give up command, and he did something that nobody expected him to do, that nobody had done. No Roman had done, anyway, in hundreds of years. He took the army and he marched on Rome. To bring an army against a Roman army against Rome was against all of Rome's most ancient laws and customs. All but one of Sulla's officers resigned rather than follow that order. Marius did not anticipate the move. Sulla won, forced himself to be put in charge of the war against Mithridates, and left to go fight Mithridates. And I guess this is what Mithridates becomes almost a footnote in his own rebellion. Sulla goes off there, fights him, beats him, doesn't even seem to break into a sweat in doing so. You wonder whether there was any real danger to Rome. And in fact, there's some that you start to look at the circumstantial evidence, and Marius may have been maneuvering the whole time to get Mithridates, to push Mithridates to rebel, so he would have the opportunity of getting that command, only to have Sulla come in and take it. But he's just swept aside so easily, and all of the major fighting is just going on within these two Romans to try and see who gets to the opportunity to go fight him. But while Sulla's away beating Mithridates, Marius returns to Rome and once again gets himself put in charge of Rome. And so Sulla returns, marches on Rome again, and once again, there's a battle at the gates of Rome, and Sulla wins. And once again, or perhaps more so than at any point since her ancient history, Rome has a king in all but in name. Sulla becomes dictator. He can kill whoever he likes. Anybody who displeases him is put on a list, a proscription list, and they're dead and all their property is taken. He can set laws. He is basically able to rule without any kind of restraint. Completely changes Rome's constitution. And then steps down, walks away, and enjoys 2 years of retirement before his death. And that was basically the history of Rome from then on till the end of the Roman Republic. Some uncontrolled part of the Mediterranean would threaten Rome. A strong man would very reluctantly be given extraordinary powers to go and deal with the threat. And then the strong man would gain huge power in Rome, checked only by potential rivals. So you just had another set of strongmen once Sulla left the scene. Pompey, Sulla's right-hand man, nicknamed the Kid Butcher because of both his ferocity and his youth. Crassus, previously Sulla's right-hand man, who fell out of favor with the dictator. And Gaius Julius Caesar, a relative of Marius who'd been forced to flee from Sulla. And these three became the next generation of strongmen to fight throughout the Mediterranean and to fight Rome. Once these three had fought it out, you had basically another generation, Mark Antony and Octavian, fighting Brutus and Cassius. After that, you had Octavian fighting Antony. By the end of it, all of the Mediterranean was under Roman control, so that no uppity ruler could rise and take on Rome again. And Rome had accepted having an emperor, one single leader with absolute power, so that there would be no more fights between rival strongmen. We'll take one more break, and when we get back, we'll start to then look at, well, what can we learn from this history?
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Hello, and welcome back to The Trumpet Daily radio show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. We've done a very sweeping overview of the history of Rome, focusing on a few aspects of it. Personally, I find this history fascinating, but why is this of interest today? What to make on it? Make of it? But I think there are some important things that this teaches that we tend to not understand so well today. All right, geography doesn't change. And so you can see from that history a lot about the geography of the Mediterranean and about how that affects world events. What happens anywhere in the Mediterranean is always going to affect southern Europe. It's all connected. Now, this is what drew Rome out across both Europe and North Africa and into the Middle East. It's what drove Rome to completely wipe out a city on the coast of North Africa. Now, those two empires, Rome and Carthage, had 100 years of closely intertwined history. You know, we tend to think today, I think, of kind of like Europe and Africa, and they're very different places, as if there's a massive gulf separating them. But having some of this historical context makes it clear that's not the case. You know, they're part of one system. Yes, there are a lot of differences between, you know, they've had major differences in terms of economic history, differences of religion, different heritages, but they're not as divided as we kind of tend to think, as we just block them into these two different continents. And so just as Rome was drawn out across this whole region, we see the European Union doing exactly the same thing today. You know, the threats are different, but the pattern is the same. Just as at first Rome didn't actually conquer a lot of these places, well, Europe's doing the same thing. In a lot of ways, it's not, well, it definitely isn't conquering, say, different nations in North Africa. It's not going out and actually taking over Tunisia or anything like that. But it is getting much more involved with their governments, with their border forces. And you could read a lot of growing reports from people on the ground, especially in Niger, a key hub for migrants coming to Italy, of just a much bigger European presence, not just in terms of European soldiers, but more in terms of European money. They're funneling millions to Niger's border guards. They're helping them catch migrants that are trying to cross their borders. They're setting up a local military. There's the G5 Sahel Force, is what it's called. In theory, it's got about 5,000 troops from Niger, Burkina Faso, Chad, and Mauritania. And the idea is to create this force that can travel anywhere between those five countries to fight terrorism, to track down, to fight anything that could basically cause migrants to come to Europe. It's a local army manned by these countries, but paid for in large part by Europe, with different European countries giving tens of millions to set it up. You've got Germany leading a mission to train both the police and the army in Mali. You've got Italy working closely, side by side with the Italian Navy, training them, giving them boats. Or at least, given how divided Italy is, the Navy of Libya is one of the factions. You've got Germany with major arms sales to Algeria, setting up a factory that creates, or setting up, yeah, I think it's either a factory or a massive contract to sell a lot of armored personnel carriers that you need for patrolling borders, a lot of work with the Algerian Navy. You're getting now just these North African navies that are using European equipment that who's being trained by Europe so that their whole practice, their weapon systems, their ammunition, their way of fighting can just dovetail perfectly with European navies and with their neighbors so that you've got this force that Europe can work with really easily. So they're doing that with Algeria. Germany sold submarines and major naval equipment to Egypt. Then with Turkey, you know, Turkey's been building a 10-foot-high wall with its border with Syria. It's been receiving billions from Europe for help with the migrant crisis. They're helping Turkey pay for this wall. They're giving Turkey tens of millions to a Turkish arms company to build vehicles to patrol the borders. They're giving Turkey cash for patrol boats along their Turkish border. So you're really seeing Europe move into the Mediterranean and start to form these links with these Mediterranean countries. And we had Mr. Trump's visit to Europe last week, and if anything, you could expect that process to intensify. America is also involved in North Africa to a much greater extent than a lot of people realize. And we saw that where it was, I think, about 6 months ago, where some U.S. service personnel died in, I think it was Nigeria, I'm not sure exactly where, but one of these countries in Northwest Africa. And then the big response in America was kind of like, oh, we had soldiers there? But the U.S. has a pretty big presence across that area. And if they're not going to be having that presence, or if at least if they're not going to be supporting Europe, well, that's just going to force Europe to step it up. And so by looking at some of this shared history with Africa and Europe, with Rome, you see that there is a very close connection between Europe and the Mediterranean. And Europe's strategy to control the Mediterranean is something Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Mr. Gerald Flurry has been talking about for years because of how important this is to Europe. And if you look at what European leaders and what action they've been taking, what they've been saying, they know this. They understand this history. They understand how important controlling all the way around the Mediterranean is for their power in the world. Here's a clip from a 2011 Key of David called The Rise of Germany.
But just how concerned do you think Germany is about the Mediterranean Sea and Africa? Do they think about that part of the world? Well, you need to get a map and look at where Malta is and where Cyprus is. And let me read you another short quote here that is very revealing about Europe's plans for Africa and the Mediterranean Sea. Back in March 2000, Prodi, the president of the EU at the time, made this statement: Malta is the southern pillar of Europe. And if Malta joined the EU, it wasn't a member at that time, but it is now, it would become a gateway for Europe. Malta has been described as a springboard to the whole Mediterranean region, and especially to the African and Middle Eastern shores. So here they are talking about reaching into all the Mediterranean Sea and into Cyprus and even down into Africa.
So Europe's had this strong focus on the Mediterranean. Mr. Flurry talked about this on the same show in the context of the Balkans, because Germany really pushed hard to have Yugoslavia broken up. And as soon as it did that, well, very quickly, Croatia with its Mediterranean coast was brought into the European Union, and Slovenia as well. That at the time, it was very well recognized people watching the world news that Germany was behind that breakup. In the UN, people were calling it, I think it was Dietrich Genscher's war, because the German foreign minister then, Genscher, had pushed for that so hard. There was another US official who said Germany bears a certain responsibility for that war. They really pushed to have Yugoslavia broken up, and a big part of the reason is to gain control over that part of the Mediterranean. Here's what Mr. Flurry said about that from this same program.
Now, why would you think Germany was so insistent on offending the whole world and maybe even getting in a conflict with the rest of the world just over Slovenia and Croatia? Well, those two countries are on the Adriatic Sea, and they have warm water ports, and that Adriatic Sea leads right out into the Mediterranean. Now, Germany knows how important the Mediterranean is, and Germany knows about strategic warfare probably better than any nation in the world. Now, they are thinking about expanding their power, I would think, wouldn't you? Now, if you look also, they were able to swing Albania around, and if you look on a map, and we'll show you this on a map, but there is a Durrës port there right at the end of the Adriatic Sea where it meets the Mediterranean. And here the Germans have a wonderful port and really a very great control in Albania. All you have to do is get a map and follow and see what's happening and what kind of a strategy Germany has. You can see what they're thinking and what they're planning. They have big plans for the Mediterranean Sea and Africa. But
now with the migrant crisis, you can really see why Germany had those big plans for Africa and the Mediterranean. All of those places are becoming crucial to the migrant crisis. If you want to stop migrants coming up from Turkey into Europe, well, the Balkans, very handy for doing that because that's where they come from. If you want to stop or come up through, I should say. And then if you want to help Italy out, well, Europe's now moving more and more into North Africa. Just sticking with the Balkans for a couple more minutes, you're seeing the EU now holding out membership to Albania and Macedonia. On June 26th, the EU General Affairs Council, they decided that these two countries had finally made enough progress on civil reforms to give them a cautious green light to move forward with EU membership. So, for quite a number of years now, Europe's been saying, nope, we're not in it. We're not in a good condition. We're dealing with these crises. We're in no condition to take on new members. Can't do it. Now they're saying, well, if you make a few changes, you can begin membership talks in 2019 with the goal of joining the EU in 2025. Why has that changed? Why are they now trying to get these guys into the EU? Well, you heard from Mr. Flurry why they're so focused on the Balkans. And I think after that area broke up, then Germany got the bits they were most keen on, Slovakia and, Slovenia and Croatia. Yeah, they got those countries in and brought those into the European Union. They had a strong influence in the rest, and they weren't too worried about formal control. Now you see Russia and China, especially China, getting much more involved in that area, and Germany starting to realize, okay, well, we need to extend our formal control into these other blank spaces. Because if we don't, they're going to get filled up, and we'll get threatened from these blank spaces. And you're seeing the same gradual process that Rome went through, where there was the potential for threat from any spot around the Mediterranean that they didn't control, and so they ended up moving into all of the blank spaces until they had the whole Mediterranean coastline. Europe's going through exactly that same process now. And even some of the history is even more similar. I mean, Europe, a lot of their threat from the area, it's terrorism, it's migrants, it's right now, it's not necessarily a massive state, like Mithridates or Carthage, but Rome had times where they had to deal with that as well. They came under huge economic pressure from pirates that were operating in the Mediterranean, restricting shipping. And eventually Pompey was given an unprecedented command, authority, military authority over all of the Mediterranean to go deal with the pirates. And he had to deal with the blank spaces around the Mediterranean. It's in the similar way that Europe, if they're going to get to grips with terrorism and terrorism affecting the Mediterranean, well, they need to be able to fill in all the blank spaces, have control over all of it. But there's another power that also wants influence in the Mediterranean. Daniel chapter 11 talks about a king of the south. A king of the south. And this power, it says, is allied. It singles out a couple of specific nations. And we've said for years that the king of the south is radical Islam led by Iran. You can read more about that in our King of the South booklet. But here's how Mr. Flurry describes or talks about what the Bible adds to what the king of the south is doing with by talking about some of these allies.
Verse 43, and here we'll see that I think two nations that are going to also ally themselves closely with Iran, if not be controlled by them. This is Daniel 11, but he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. Now, why would God have those two nations mentioned in there? Well, if you just would get a map and look at it closely, you'll see that both of them are on that trade route going through the Red Sea and the Mediterranean Sea. And you could see where the king of the south, if he gets control of Egypt or influences them primarily, they're right there on the Mediterranean as well, as is Libya and Ethiopia, at least on the Red Sea. So there is a strategy here. I think you can see from what is happening in the Middle East, there is a strategy by radical Islam to get control of that whole trade route going through the Red Sea and the Mediterranean Sea, where goods flow all the time and a lot of oil. Most of the world's oil flows through there, at least coming to Europe and to the U.S.
So they're rising to challenge Europe in the Mediterranean. And just like in Rome, when there's a challenge in the Mediterranean, Germany has to respond. And if anything, the Mediterranean's become even more important today because our civilizations are so reliant on fossil fuels, on oil and gas. And where does Europe get those fossil fuels from? Well, so many of them come from the Middle East. They come from North Africa. There's pipelines that come under the sea from Algeria. There's a huge amount of shipborne oil that comes up through the Red Sea and then into the Mediterranean. Then you've got pipelines going through Turkey, and that, you know, the Mediterranean coast, near to the Mediterranean coastline. So if anything, they've become even more connected, way more connected than they were in Roman times. Mr. Flurry talks about this in an article that he wrote in July 2016, Mediterranean Battle Escalating into World War III. And he talked a lot about history. He talked about more recent history of World War II, where again you see the Allies trying to defeat Germany in Northern Europe. And where do they start doing that? The Mediterranean. They're fighting in North Africa, trying to stop Rommel. And finally, General Montgomery and the British stop him at El Alamein, and he's forced into retreat. There's the Operation Torch, the landings in North Africa and West Africa. They're defeated, they're pushed out, but that's all part of the war with Europe. Mr. Flurry in that article writes, many historians realize that had Churchill not been able to halt Rommel's advance to control the Suez Canal, the entire Mediterranean theater would have been lost to the Nazis and could have changed the outcome of the war. Germany needed to dominate the Mediterranean in order to win. He writes, now 70 years later, times are different. Instead of World War II allies' powers being in control, North Africa and the land around the Red Sea are governed by unstable dictatorships and radical Islamic terrorist groups that seek to bring the fight to Europe. But this time around, Germany has learned its lesson. It will not allow Europe's soft underbelly to be controlled by its enemy. For this reason, Germany is moving once again to conquer the Mediterranean. So we see this push down in the Mediterranean. So that's one of the big things that we can see from this shared history. Now, I also, I've only got like 2 minutes or less left, but I also want to talk about just the connection here with the rise of strong leaders too. And I think that's another interesting thing that comes right out of this history. I mean, I think the history can as well just give us context even beyond specific application so that we can just get a better understanding of our own world. But you can see how Rome's control of the Mediterranean happened at the same time as the rise of these strongmen. Because these threats that came from elsewhere in the Mediterranean, they change a nation. Rome was all about separation of powers, just like Europe today is committed to democracy. But you face a disaster or two like Carnae or Mithridates kicking you out of Greece or pirates threatening your economy. And then suddenly, well, you're fine with a dictator. You're fine with giving someone powers that you wouldn't do otherwise. These threats, often from the Mediterranean, they changed Rome's acceptance to the point they were quite happy to have a strong man, and to the point they were willing to just wipe out cities and civilizations entirely. And the Bible also talks about Europe getting a strong man at the same time that it invades the Middle East. Daniel chapter 8, Daniel chapter 11 talk about that. It's very hard to have this kind of decisive action without a strong man. Even the UK suspended elections in World War II. Abraham Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus in the Civil War. So no wonder Rome struggled to avoid a strong man in the course of these wars. Well, that really is about all we've got time for. You can read a lot more about that subject in Mr. Flurry's article, Mediterranean Battle Escalating into World War III. And we'd love to send you our free booklet, The King of the South, that talks about this clash that revolves around the Mediterranean between Europe and Iran. You can get that. You can order that for free at our website, thetrumpet.com. Well, thanks for listening. You can also email the show at kpcg or td at kpcg.fm and tune in again tomorrow when Mr. Stephen Flurry will be back on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show.